Happy New Year's greetings and annular manifestations, my grammatronically Zarkreptian listeners, and welcome to this January 2018 Science News Update. I'm your host for this diminutively minuscule titbit of a science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. I hope the New Year's treating everyone okay. So far, I can't complain very much, but we'll see what the new semester brings. I get the impression that you guys are now expecting a winner each month for Idiot Scientist of the Month. That may be a little harder than you think, believe it or not. But I've got one for you. Although I must question if being a dishonest scumbag is equitable to being an idiot. There is a fine line that separates stupid and evil, and I will tell you in a bit which side of the line this month's winner falls upon. Dr. Fazlul Sarkar, cancer researcher formerly working for Wayne State University, was found by an investigative committee to have engaged in research conduct. And he has racked up his 19th paper retraction. This was reported last week by Retraction Watch. Yes, that's 19 papers that were complete BS, folks. Many pretty decent scientists may publish that many papers over a good portion of their careers, depending on how long it takes to gather data. But this schmuck just decided he would take the shortcut of all that boring data gathering and laboratory work and just make stuff up. The good Dr. Sarkar has become famous in the last several years, both because of his misconduct of making up research and his unsuccessful 2016 lawsuit against PubPeer.com. The lawsuit sought to force the online discussion site to reveal the identity of commenters who alleged misconduct on his part. Sarkar's newest retraction from last month is of a 2012 study in the journal Cancer Letters entitled "Increased RAS GTPase Activity is Regulated by MicroRNAs That Can Be Attenuated by CDF Treatment in Pancreatic Cancer Cells." The retraction notice explains that the Wayne State investigation found a discrepancy between the originally collected data from Sarkar's lab notebooks and those reported in two of the paper's figures. 2 years ago, when Sarkar was first canned, Wayne State University advocated in a report that 42 of his papers be retracted because they're complete nonsense. Of those 42, more than half of those crappy publications are still out there in the publication universe and continue to plague anybody innocent or ignorant enough to have faith in this pathetic moron. Let me make an editorial comment here on how low I consider this guy. Now, if I was to make up laboratory data, it would be a serious breach of the public trust, and plain dishonest and stupid. But I'm a plant biologist, and I do obscure work on protein evolution. I am not likely to actually hurt anyone if I fantasize about how some esoteric gene evolved in some esoteric plant species. However, if you are going to make up data, why in the bloody hell would you become a cancer researcher? Your results mean something to the survival of very sick people around the world. If you concoct lab results, you could hurt or cause the death of hundreds, perhaps thousands of people over decades who are already suffering. This is why I place Dr. Sarkar firmly on the side of evil as opposed to stupid. You wonder why we don't have a cure for cancer yet? Well, this submoron is one reason. Apparently, he decided his career and grants and publications were more important than any harm he could do to the world at large and cancer research for decades to come. You think that professors should be held to a higher standard? Well, I do. In the last few months, you will notice that lots of powerful men in Hollywood have been accused of being sexual harassers, the most famous being the movie producer Harvey Weinstein. Believe it or not, professors and PIs at big universities can be just as powerful as anybody in Hollywood. This gets us into an entirely new area that few people talk about, sexual harassment by university faculty. Now remember, if you take a university class from someone, then you are essentially at their mercy as far as your grades are concerned. If they are dishonest or manipulative, then you may be in serious trouble. This is worse if you're a foreign national and working in their laboratory and doing work for your PhD. If you just get overworked or spend an extra year or two in lab servitude, then you may be the lucky one. Dishonest people in power will gravitate toward taking advantage of those who have no power, whether they are famous actors, directors, or professors. And the industry in this case, academia, will often continue to protect them. The Journal of the Scientist had an extensive article on this type of abuse in their December issue. The author of the story, Anna Aswalinski, cited many instances of abuse. For example, in 2016 at the University of Rochester, grad students and current and former professors within the Department of Brain and Cognitive Sciences filed complaints accusing Professor Florian Jaeger of sexual harassment and intimidation. But the university cleared him of violating the school's harassment and discrimination policy even after an appeal by several of the faculty members. Worse, the university promoted him to full professor, even while the internal investigation was ongoing. This September, after the accusers submitted formal complaints to the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the university finally placed Jaeger on leave, and the University of Rochester president said he regretted promoting Jaeger in the first place. Here's another one. Dr. Jeffrey Marcy, a former University of California astronomy professor, was found to have sexually harassed multiple students over the span of a decade. Although the university's own internal proceedings took place in 2015, Marcy was not penalized until the records were published in 2016. And then he received only a mild reprimand by the vice provost of Berkeley's faculty, involving an agreement that held Marcy to, quote, clear expectations, unquote, regarding his future interactions with students. Otherwise, he could get suspended or fired in the future. It was only after subsequent public outrage, including a letter to the New York Times, penned by 278 of Marcy's peers, who expressed concern that Marcy had been portrayed in too positive a light, that Marcy finally resigned. Here's one more. The University of Southern California reportedly did nothing for years about complaints of Keck School of Medicine Dean Carmen Pugliafito. Apparently, he was big into illegal drug use, and also apparently he mistreated his colleagues. Again, it took news reports that made the university administration look like they were equally guilty that forced Dean Pugliafito to resign. Why does this happen? Why let these ratbags get away with murder? Now, the article suggests that part of the reason why universities are not eager to remove high-ranking professors has to do with maintaining the ability of their faculty to secure grants. The article states, quote, "The first thought is always to protect the brand. As federal and state dollars dry up and grant money slows, schools need to strive to protect and enhance their reputations, making the management of misbehaving and exploitative faculty members sensitive to the financial woes of the institution," unquote. I guess when millions of dollars are at stake, university administrators are no different than somebody running a movie studio. It's loathsome to think that PIs with lots of grants or who bring fame and visibility to an academic institution can just slither their way through the current system. Ew. All right, let's climb out of the muck here and talk about real science before I'm nauseated. Ugh. Okay, having been in Oregon within the last few months, I once again am worried about the legalization of marijuana across the U.S. I'm not worried about the ethical moral issues. I'm much more worried about the long-term health effects of making pot legal for home use. Compared to tobacco, not much is known about the long-term effects of cannabis use. I mean, partly because in the U.S. it's classified as a Schedule I drug by the DEA, That means it has high potential for abuse and no demonstrated medicinal value. Ironically, though users are finding it easier to obtain nowadays, researchers who want to study cannabis face onerous bureaucratic procedures to officially access it. Obviously, if you have trouble getting cannabis, then you are going to have a hard time demonstrating any medicinal value of cannabis. It's also difficult to determine any threats to the public health that legalization may bring. In a 2017 article in Trends in Neuroscience, Dr. Yasmeen Hurd, director of the Addiction Institute at Mount Sinai Behavioral Health System, did studies on cannabis and the epigenetic changes that may come about by long-term use. Remember, epigenetics deals with changes in your genome made by alterations in the environment around you, and that they can be passed along to the next generation. Hurd's team found that tetrahydrocannabinol, THC, which is the psychoactive component of marijuana, increases heroin self-administration in adults who were exposed to THC as adolescents. Hurd explains, quote, "Marijuana in the young brain acts like a neurobiological gateway. But it's worse than that. Our results show that THC even has cross-generational effects. Adult rats whose parents were exposed to THC as teen rats self-administer more heroin, suggesting that THC affects the germline itself." Unquote. Hurd was not surprised by this because apparently epigenetic changes aren't unique to marijuana use. Hurd's team published a paper last year that showed a pattern of epigenetic alterations in brains of human heroin users that affected the activity of genes that regulate signaling. Hurd's team found that epigenetic changes in rat brains were similar to those in human heroin-addicted brains. The upshot is that both your heroin and cannabis usage may lead your young children down the same path eventually. This is the first time anyone has shown this possibility. Next story. Something a bit more happy. This is an update on the Tabby's Star mystery. You may remember that I talked about the mystery of its flickering in real time. One of the theories explaining that flickering was a gigantic alien structure orbiting the star and causing it to wink in and out. Well, the star's most recent winks show that the dimming is from small dust particles surrounding it. A team of more than 200 scientists and amateur astronomers reported this result on January 3rd at the online journal archive.org. The oddball star, officially named KIC-8462852, is best known for its sudden drops in brightness. Astronomers have invoked everything from evaporating comets to an enormous edifice built by intelligent aliens to explain the sporadic winks. Back in March 2016, Dr. Tabitha Boyajian, for whom the star is named, of Louisiana State University, began trying to catch light dips in the act using two automatic ground-based telescopes with the Las Cumbres Observatory, a worldwide network of telescopes. On May 18, 2017, as Tabby's star started to dim, at least 12 other telescopes rushed to follow up. That event turned out to be the first of four distinct light dips between May and the end of December, when the star moved behind the sun from Earth's perspective. Boyajian and colleagues report that the star grew dimmer in blue wavelengths than in red ones. That dimming is best explained by dust particles less than a micrometer in size. She says, quote, "If a large opaque object, say an alien megastructure, was blocking the star, then multiple telescopes should see the same level of dimming across many wavelengths of light. An earlier paper reported the same wavelength difference in the star's dimming spanning several years, but this is the first time it's been seen for the short-term dips," unquote. However, every time you come up with an explanation, you create other difficulties. The space dust raises a new mystery. That dust should not just stay there. The dust is small enough that the star's radiation, the solar wind, should blow it away, so something must be constantly creating more dust. Boyajian explains, "None of the ideas we have at this point are really great at putting all the pieces together. Yeah, it's dust, but where's it coming from? That's still up in the air." Unquote. Since we were talking about astronomy, why don't we stick to that topic? Ever wonder what the inside of a dwarf star might look like? I have, especially since I recently narrated E.E. Doc Smith's Skylark 3. Smith actually talked about this back at the beginning of the last century. There's even a scene where two characters from the novel are projected into the center of a white dwarf to gather star material. So how accurate was the imagination of old Doc Smith? Well, not bad for a flight of fancy from the 1920s. Dr. Nomi Giammichele and colleagues of the Institute of Research in Astrophysics and Planetology have finally probed the inner life of a collapsed dead star. Tiny changes in a white dwarf's brightness reveal that the stellar corpse has more oxygen in its core than expected. This was reported by the researchers in the journal Nature in January 8th. The finding could change theories of how stars live and die, and may have implications for measuring the expansion of the universe. As a star ages, it sheds most of its gas into space until all that remains is a dense core of carbon and oxygen. The ashes of a lifetime of burning helium, you see. That core, plus a thin shellacking of helium, is called, well, a white dwarf. But the proportion of those elements relative to one another was uncertain. Luckily, some white dwarfs encode their inner nature on their surface. These stars change their brightness in response to internal vibrations. Astrophysicists can infer a star's internal structure from the vibrations, similar to how geologists learn about the Earth's interior by measuring seismic waves during an earthquake. Giammichele and her colleagues used data from NASA's Kepler Space Telescope, which watched stars unblinkingly to track periodic changes in their brightness. The Kepler telescope monitored the white dwarf KIC0862601, which is located 1,375 light-years away from here in the constellation Cygnus. And the telescope studied it for 23 months. The observations provided the highest precision data ever on tiny changes in a white dwarf's brightness, and indirectly its vibrations. Giammichele then analyzed how the changes in vibrations related to the makeup of the core. The team ran millions of simulations looking for one that reproduced the exact light changes that the Kepler observed. One simulation fit the data perfectly, showing that the white dwarf had the expected carbon and oxygen core with a thin shell of helium. The model suggested that the core was about 86% oxygen, which is 15% greater than physicists had predicted previously. That suggests that something about the processes that convert helium to carbon and oxygen, or mix elements in the star's core during its active lifetime, must somehow boost the amount of oxygen. No one is really sure whether this is important or not. Giammichele says, quote, "Our results may someday help reveal details of what dark energy is made of. However, just how much bearing that extra oxygen will have on cosmology remains to be seen." Unquote. Next story. As regular listeners to the podcast know, my dad has had worsening Alzheimer's for the last several years. No treatment has helped, and several actually have made it worse. There's still no clear evidence how much of Alzheimer's cause is genetic and how much is environmental, although my mother will insist that my dad's years as a pharmaceutical research chemist is the main reason for his illness. Will I get it? I have no idea. I may turn into a potato brain eventually being if and when I get into my 80s like my father. However, frankly, it terrifies me every time I forget where my car keys are, although I have been told by psychology friends that this is normal for middle age, and it would be more of an indicator of Alzheimer's if you forgot what your car keys were for than just misplacing them. That seems like rather cold comfort to me. However, a new drug has emerged that may reverse Alzheimer's, although, as usual, do not get too excited yet. Studies in a mouse model of Alzheimer's disease have shown how a drug that was originally developed to treat diabetes demonstrates what researchers in the UK and China call, quote, clear promise as a treatment for Alzheimer's and other neurodegenerative disorders in humans. The studies, led by Dr. Christian Holscher of Lancaster University, confirmed that the Alzheimer's mice treated using a triple receptor agonist showed, quote, significantly reversed memory loss, unquote, as well as reduced neuroinflammation and oxidative stress, lower amyloid plaque load in the brain, and increased levels of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is a key growth factor that protects synaptic function. The paper reporting on this breakthrough was published in the journal Brain Research last month. Remember I said that no one quite understands the genetics and environmental risks of Alzheimer's? Well, one of those risks seems to be type 2 diabetes. That association motivated Holscher to investigate whether anti-diabetic drugs might also be effective against Alzheimer's. Studies have shown that the hormones glucagon-like peptide 1 and glucose-dependent insulotropic polypeptide, which have anti-diabetic properties, can play a neuroprotective role in the brain and have demonstrated promising effects in animal models of Alzheimer's. Holscher's team turned to a triple receptor agonist that activates glucagon-like 1 peptide and glucose-dependent insulotropic polypeptide and glucagon receptors. The drug had previously been in development for treating diabetes but hadn't been assessed for any neuroprotective properties. They tested the drug in a mouse model of Alzheimer's that demonstrated the hallmark symptoms of the disease, including memory loss, brain inflammation, amyloid plaque formation, synaptic loss, etc. The drug significantly reversed memory loss in mice through a triple method of action. This is the first time that a triple receptor drug has been used, which acts in multiple ways to protect the brain from degeneration. It combines the activation of three different growth factors. And problems with growth factor signaling have been shown to be impaired in the brains of Alzheimer's patients. This is great news. The results show that a daily injection of the drug reversed memory loss in Alzheimer mice, which was assessed in a spatial water maze test. Holscher says, quote, "Furthermore, treatment reduced the total amount of beta amyloid, reduced neuroinflammation and oxidative stress in the cortex and hippocampus. The results demonstrate for the first time that the novel GLP-GIP-GCG receptor agonist has clear neuroprotective effects in the APP-PS1 mouse model of Alzheimer's," unquote. I'm happy to say that according to the paper, clinical trials are now underway to investigate the neuroprotective effects of the new drug in patients with Alzheimer's and patients with Parkinson's disease. The researchers acknowledge that further dose response tests will be needed, as well as direct comparisons with other drugs, to determine whether the new drug is more effective against neurodegenerative disorders than previously developed drugs. I find this awesome, since it's the first serious breakthrough in Alzheimer's treatment in years, as far as I've seen. If it works its way through the U.S. Food and Drug Administration quickly enough, it may even help my dad. All right, last story of the night. Once again, we turn to the science of sex, gender, and reproduction. Why? Well, why not? It certainly interests us all, doesn't it? All right. For years, I have been teaching my genetics classes that the default in human development is the female body. That in order to get a male body, you need to induce male development. And that the Y chromosome has all the inductive capabilities to produce a male. No Y chromosome, or any part of it, and you do not get a male. Well, as usual, with those things that you believe are the gospel truth, it's more complicated than what I have believed for years and what I have taught for years. A little more complicated. So it appears that the female developmental pathway is not simply a default. There is a protein called CoupTF2, which is necessary to eliminate male reproductive tissue from female mouse embryos. Researchers reported this in the August 18th edition of the journal Science. The study was done by Dr. Humphrey Yao of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences in Durham, North Carolina. The new research overturns the idea of females being the default and shows that making female reproductive organs is a more active process that involves dismantling a primitive male tissue called the Wolfian duct first. Here's the basic anatomy lesson of the day. In males, the Wolfian duct develops into the parts that are needed to ejaculate sperm. That includes the epididymis, the vas deferens, and the seminal vesicles. In females, a similar embryonic tissue called the Mullerian duct develops into the fallopian tubes, uterus, and vagina. Both duct tissues are present in early embryos. 70 years ago, in a classic developmental biology study by French endocrinologist Alfred Yost, he found that the testes make testosterone and an anti-Mullerian hormone to maintain the Wolfian duct and suppress female tissue development. If those hormones are missing, the Wolfian duct degrades and an embryo, by default, develops as female. That result is what has been in every textbook since, and that is what I have taught. But it is more complex than that. Yao and colleagues set out to learn how tissues on the outside of the early ducts communicate with the tube's lining. But they discovered something more than that. The COOP TF2 protein is produced in that outer layer, and Yao suspected that it was involved somehow in signaling with the lining. He didn't know how. So, he and his research colleagues blocked the communication in early female mouse embryos' reproductive tissue by just removing the gene that produces COOP TF2. To the team's surprise, the Wolfian duct remained in the female mouse along with the female Mullerian duct. That shouldn't happen, according to the textbooks. Yao says, quote, "We were very confused and just scratching our heads," unquote. Searching for an explanation, Yao and his colleagues first tested whether removing the COOP TF2 changed the ovaries to produce testosterone like testes do. And testosterone could feed the male tissue and allow it to persist. Well, at least that's what they thought. But that was not the case. Yao says it was a no-go. Quote, "Nope. The ovary was just like any other ovary. There was nothing weird or wrong about it. We were just shocked. This could not happen. Worse, we checked in further experiments and found that no stray testosterone was responsible for the male tissue sticking around," unquote. So what was going on? COOP TF2 appears to be the foreman, so to speak, of a biochemical wrecking crew that demolishes the Wolfian duct in females. Without the protein barking orders, the demolition crew does nothing, and the male duct is not torn down. The signal that triggers COOP TF2 production and activity aren't really yet understood, so it's going to get even more complex. As usual, there's a caveat to these studies because they were done with mice, and it may not work quite the same with other mammals. However, Yao seems confident that while the study used mice, COOP TF2 probably works the same way in other mammals, including humans. There are many genetic faults that can lead to so-called sex reversal, but mutations in COOP TF2 could be an entirely new class of defect that human geneticists may want to look into. All right then, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Do not abuse your power if you have any. Remember, to make a girl, you need sugar, spice, and COOP TF2. Keep watching the skies, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.